We're joined today by Stephen Apostoloff and Corey Cropper, also David Kilpatrick, Melissa Forbis, and Ben Healy. There's four of us here in Lansing. We can just go around real quick and introduce ourselves very briefly so that everyone knows each other, and then we'll get started with the discussion about our film for the day, Once in a Lifetime. So why don't we start with Stephen?
All right. I just completed my PhD dissertation, which was a case study about professional soccer in Massachusetts. And I'm a part-time faculty at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell.
Corey Cropper of Brigham Young University. My book is called Playing at Monarchy. It's on sports and French literature. And I'm working on another project now that deals with soccer a little bit. So thanks for inviting me.
Great. How about David?
David Kilpatrick. I'm an associate professor of English literature and philosophy at Mercy College in New York. Early stages of a history of pro soccer in New York called Soccer Off Broadway.
And Melissa?
Hi, I'm Melissa Forbis. I'm a cultural anthropologist and faculty at Stony Brook University. I'm teaching a first-year undergraduate course on soccer and globalization and working on Latin America, race, gender, and soccer.
Thank you. And Ben?
I'm Ben Healy, writer and editor based in Austin, Texas. Formerly of The Atlantic Magazine, received my MFA from Mitchell Center for Writers at the University of Texas last year, and working on a novel that deals in large part with soccer.
Thank you. And we'll start off with Peter here in East Lansing.
I'm Peter Ledge. I'm a historian of South Africa and of football, and a co-founder of the Football Scholars Forum.
And Chipande.
Yes, I'm Hegawach Pande from Zambia, a PhD student in African history, Professor Aleji's student looking at football in Zambia.
I'm Ben Detmer, I'm a PhD student in American Studies, and I'm interested in soccer and 20th century U.S. cultural history.
And I'm Alex Galarza. My research focuses on soccer in Argentina, and I'm a third year here in the history department. So, Stephen, why don't you go ahead and introduce our guest for the day?
Okay. I'm honored to introduce Ray Hudson. Ray was born in Gateshead, England, Northern England, very close to Newcastle. He started playing as an apprentice for Newcastle United. After a few years, he came to the Fort Lauderdale Strikers on loan first, and he fell in love with the United States and especially with Florida. He moved permanently to the NASL in 78. He got a very impressive career there for a little bit less than 200 games. As a midfielder, he scored more than 40 goals. He played along some icons such as Kubias, Muller, Gordon Banks. Ray has a very unique background because he was one of the very few people who was involved with the old NASL and as well as MLS. He coached the Miami Fusion 2000-2001. And at that point, actually, MLS was pretty bad. He would just fall asleep watching the other teams. Ray's team was very attractive to watch. Was one of the best teams, and they were unfortunate lose a playoff game. Otherwise, they could have been champions. And he ended up his coaching career with DC United. Right after his tenure, DC United picked up he built the team, and Peter Novak, with almost the same players, won a championship title after that. And he's working currently with Goal TV. And let me tell you something. I'm about to move out. The first thing I did is I called up the cable company to figure out whether they have Goal TV. They told me no, and I'm not considering this place. The first thing that I do when I move, when I rent a place, is to figure out if they have Goal TV. If they don't have a Goal TV, I don't go there. If they have Goal TV on the North Pole, I'll move there. And I would finish with this. Back to Lansing.
Great. Well, Ray, we've all watched this movie Once in a Lifetime. But I also want to let you know that our interests are all things NASL. So as much as you want to deviate from the movie, we're very interested to hear about a non-Cosmos perspective lived on your end. But why don't we start by just asking you for your general thoughts on on the movie and its portrayal of that era.
Well, yeah, thank you. I'd just like to say the thanks right off. The lovely introduction, and very, very pleased to be here with this wonderful think tank. I feel very on nerves with such eggheads around me, but never mind. All lovers of the game, that's for sure, and that's why we're all here. Yeah, I enjoyed the movie. I thought it was a really nice, pretty fairly balanced view of an absolute halcyon era of football in this country, which I was so pleased and proud to be a part of at the very start of it. I think it was 1977 where it really had this starburst effect across the country, and it was 76, I think, it was a big part of it as well. But 77 is when the rocket really left the launch pad, and I thought this movie fairly portrayed in a good, nicely coloured, balanced way of the genesis of the I don't want to say the birth of the game in this country, because we all know it was played a long, long time before with varying degrees of success, but it never really achieved the national prominence that the NASL did in 77. And this really nice movie caught a lot of it. I was actually upset that I was supposed to be a part of the movie myself, and one of the associate producers, directors, what you will, we had several conversations in between my travels to England when I go to visit my father, who's 94 years old now and still going strong. So I go there, spend as much time as I can with my dad. And every time they wanted to do the interview here in Fort Lauderdale, I would be in England. And every time that I was back in Florida, they were elsewhere. So it was sad that we couldn't finally meet up in Tango, because they absolutely loved some of my stories and viewpoints of that time, that very, very special time in soccer's history in this country. And I was disappointed, especially when I saw how well the movie came out. And I think I could have added even more colour to it with some of the stories that I had to tell. But they did a wonderful job, I believe, and captured it not just in the not just the mood of the country towards the game, and that wonderful seduction that took place around 1977. But you know, the use of the music I thought was very, very charming. I thought that was a great hook. The diversity of the characters were wonderful. The only thing that I didn't like about the movie was that they turned Giorgio Canali into this Richard III type of character. And George deserved way better than that. Although it was a pretty strong gang against him, I didn't quite understand that sort of thing. But as far as the movie went, it worked. And I know it wasn't a staged set of viewpoints. That was the honest opinion of these people. I have a completely different viewpoint of Kinalia myself. He was a wonderful competitor, a great sportsman in many ways. And I thought he did as much, if not more, for the New York Cosmos than anybody else. He did it his way, of course. But that sort of villain character that he was portrayed at in the movie certainly gave the picture a different focus in association with the wonderful presentation of the game that was, you know, well portrayed and captured beautifully in a big way.
Great. Thanks a lot, Ray. Well, in typical FSF tradition, we'll start by giving our online participants a question to ask, or a chance to ask some questions. And also, to everyone, don't feel as though we need to ask Ray a specific question. We can also just make general comments about the movie that you had observations, and we can turn this into sort of a roundtable as well. And anyone that wants to jump in to respond to a reflection or some analysis is welcome to do so. So question, thoughts, reflections. We'll start off in the same order that we led off with the introduction. So go ahead, Stephen.
Thank you, Alex. I agree with most of the things that Ray says. I think it's a beautiful movie. It's a shame that Ray couldn't participate because they got their rivals in Florida. They got what was the name of the player that was involved of the movie?
They asked Rodney Marsh.
Correct. So it's a shame that he couldn't participate, Ray. But on the other hand, I totally agree that it was a kind of an unfair, probably, image that they created about Giorgio Chinaglia. But some people actually, they like the movie because of that. It's a little bit like of a bad boy, like a Italian Welsh Hristo Stoichkov. You either hate it or you love it, or yeah, you worship it. And some people like the movie because of that. But I agree with you that it was probably not a completely fair image of Giorgio Chinaglia. And one comment, one follow up. I think that a new movie should be they should make a new movie kind of to probably draw a parallel between NASL and MLS, and I don't know, title it from Palace Cosmos to Beckham's Galaxy, if you wish. And I'll pass the word to somebody else.
I think that's a great idea. David had a follow-up as well, so go ahead, David.
Yeah, I obviously Clive was supposed to be here and didn't feel well enough to do so, and I don't want to try to speak for him, but I think the idea of the Richard III type character that emerges in Once in a Lifetime about Giorgio Chinaglia, I appreciate the fact that Ray doesn't feel that way about Chinaglia, and I think as a player he was incredibly accomplished. I had a poster of Chinaglia on my wall as a kid. So I did idolize him as a kid, but when you speak with a lot of the people who were involved with the Cosmos leading into that 77 season and then in the aftermath and up until 1984-85 when everything fell apart, Chinaglia's machinations behind the scenes didn't earn him any friends. And in the long term, the way he took over control of the club and really ran the franchise into the ground and the league with it, I think that does justify some of the vitriol that's spewed his way. But the question I really have for Ray is, you spent 1 year when the Strikers moved up to Minnesota. You may remember the Memphis Rogues. That was my team as a little kid too. I was a New Yorker whose dad got transferred down to Memphis, and I became a Rogues fan, and then fortunately for me, my dad was transferred back to New York in 1980. I left New York a couple weeks before the Rogues moved to Calgary. So I wanted to get your perspective on the nature of franchises here. You've been involved in that as a player, moving from Fort Lauderdale to Minnesota briefly, and then obviously with Miami. I wondered if you could speak to that and how different that is from what you grew up with in Newcastle.
Sure, that's a great question, and there's a lot of latitude to answer it within. When I first came to this country, I didn't know what the playoffs were, first of all. Let me just show you, what a different planet that I landed on when I was a 22-year-old boy from Newcastle upon Tyne into Fort Lauderdale, Florida, at spring break. When we were in our pre-season, we were watching the Yankees train right next door to us, and I was learning all about this, this wonderful new country and its sports. And in just regular conversation, one of the lads that was my teammate said, "Well, we've got to see if we can get to the playoffs. It'll be a miracle." I said, "What do you mean the playoffs?" And he explained what the playoffs were. So we play the whole season to get into this knockout tournament, and if we lose in the playoffs, It's dead. It's over. I said, yeah, that's the way it works. It was ironic that that year, that Fort Lauderdale Strikers team posted the best record in NESL. We had the best record over the Cosmos, over the Rowdies, and over all the other teams in the league. I think we finished at 19-7 in the first year. So it was phenomenal. We were the best team. We were the best team. We got into the playoffs. We got knocked out the first game, 8-3 in Giant Stadium, which for me was like, this is lunacy. Well, in the process of learning in that Cinderella season what was going on, and we played against Team Hawaii, I remember, this wonderful road trip we had at Los Angeles, at Las Vegas, and then at Hawaii, at Team Hawaii. That was one road trip. Imagine that. And the guys were telling me, well, enjoy it while you can because these franchises won't be here next year. Well, what the hell do you mean? They said, well, there's talk about them moving. Moving? I mean, how do you move a football team, a soccer team? It was so alien to me and my naivety, obviously, but my thought train of what I had grown up with. You don't move Manchester United. You know, you don't move Real Madrid. But in the United States, it was commonplace and still is. And it was just bewildering to me, to be honest. But obviously, it's part and parcel of the culture. And it's a sad thing in many, many ways, but it's the law of the land.
Yes, go ahead, David, and follow up, and then Ben can ask a question as well.
I wondered, especially, you know, you said you're down in Fort Lauderdale now. As a kid, I had the great opportunity to see you play, and that was a terrific Strikers team, and that club had such a great identity. I wondered if you thought, in terms of your involvement with MLS, if that was a mistake on their part for the Fusion to be playing in the same stadium as the Strikers used to, but not to embrace the Fort Lauderdale identity, or if not the outright Strikers brand, if that was kind of a noose around the neck of that franchise and maybe a part of the reason it didn't thrive. And I also just want to say before I ask you that, you enliven our weekends every weekend, and it's an absolute thrill to speak with you.
I greatly appreciate that. Very kind of you. It was a nightmare at the beginning with the Miami Fusion transplanting, first of all, to Miami, and then realizing that was a catastrophe. Then moving up I-95 to Lockhart Stadium and still calling themselves the Miami Fusion. That'll give you some sort of idea about who... of the lunatics running that asylum. When I arrived into the coaching position, the team was 1-8, and we turned it round to a 500 season, got to the Open Cup final, and the next year had the best record in MLS and increased the gate by 50%. That's in 2 years. Doug Hamilton, my great general manager, was a big part of that. And we produced a wonderful footballing team, very, very proud of that Miami Fusion 2001-2002 season. They were phenomenal. And the way that it dissolved really stemmed with that the terrible management model that was maintained for the first 3 years. In Miami and then in Fort Lauderdale, and just slowly crumbled and dissolved. And it was even when we resurrected the ship from the bottom of the ocean here and made it into this wonderful Spanish galleon of a footballing side, they pulled the plug and this area will never, probably never ever be trustworthy of Major League Soccer ever again. There was good reasoning behind it in some ways, but they should have allowed us another year at least. because it was going along so incredibly well. But that's the way it works. And, you know, another one bites the dust. And we weren't the first one, was by far, and we'll certainly not be the last. But it's a sad aspect of the sport in this country. But it's still, you know, it really is still putting down its roots. And MLS looks as if they've learned so much from those NASL days. That's one of the things when I was watching this lovely movie, it's how things had changed, you know, now that MLS has got the pyramid the right way up. You know, they've got a very solid base. They've been financially very, very careful. They haven't allowed Cosmos to run away from the group. Although the way the Galaxy, LA Galaxy are going, that's getting very close to pushing it that way. And I wonder if that can be maintained. And I wonder if that's such a good thing for the league. But we'll just have to wait and see.
Ben, go ahead.
Okay, thanks. Just two quick things that I found myself wondering about during the film. One was just, you know, we see limos and everything pulling up to take members of the Cosmos to Studio 54. And I was just curious what the reception was for other kind of international superstars in other NASL cities. You know, where was Johan Cruyff being whisked off to the discos of LA and DC at the time? And just, I mean, was it a big deal in other cities? I was also just wondering about the brief period where it seemed like the U.S. might have been able to get the 1986 World Cup after the problems in Colombia. And I just wonder if Ray thinks if that would have been too early for American soccer to get such a high-profile thing, if 94 was the right time for that to come along, if we would have been able to capitalize on those gains 8 years earlier with an earlier World Cup. So anyway, just curious about both those.
Yeah, the question was breaking up a little bit at this end, to be honest, but I think I caught the gist of the question.
Yeah, just to restate it real quick. I'm sorry, go ahead, Ray.
Yeah, let me just go on. I think I heard the gist of the question regarding the World Cup being trying to get the World Cup around that time during the NASL when it was at a very, very pivotal point in the tournament not going through and going through to Mexico, I believe it was, if I'm not mistaken. Certainly that would have had an enormous boost to everybody involved. I'm not sure that the timing would have been correct and right as it was. I think the timing of the World Cup that eventually did come to the United States was seemed to catch the wave beautifully, and credit obviously to everybody involved for creating that league around that tournament afterwards. And the way MLS has progressed, you know, inarguably in so many ways. So I'm not sure that a big opportunity was missed in that point. And I think there'll be a lot of people that would argue against that. And I could understand a very alternate opinion. But I'm not really sure, as seduced as a lot of pockets of this country was by much of the MLS time frame, that the country really had the appreciation or the acknowledgement even of the sport itself at the time. Whereas when the World Cup did eventually arrive on these shores, I think there was a far bigger understanding and appreciation of not just appreciation of the game, but just you know, the understanding that this was a massive event. I think I'm not sure if that would have happened back in the days of the NASL for a World Cup to arrive on these shores. I really think it might have been a little too early.
Bennett also asked a quick question about sort of the celebrity experience of the NASL's top players. He mentioned Studio 54 for the Cosmos, and he wondered if Cruyff was being given the similar treatment in L.A., and if you had any experience with that. So was there a reflection on your end on how how these top players were treated as celebrities in each of their own ecosystems for each team.
Yeah. Sure, it was strange in that part. It's a good question, because a lot of our players, like George Best, Gerd Müller, Gordon Banks, Kubilas, Elias Figueroa, these were the gods of the game. And they loved the fact that they could go to the shopping mall or the public supermarket and nobody would bat an eyelid. I mean, they enjoyed that part of it and they reveled in that anonymity. The other part of it was where they would be actually highlighted or advertised as one of the great players of world history, world soccer history, on those promotional evenings or nights or whatever, they would get an enormous turnout for exactly the celebrities. Well, they weren't called celebrities back then, but the type of wonderful artisans of the game that they were. The other stuff, you know, we would have the same sort of experiences here in Fort Lauderdale. It was the same with the Rowdies in Tampa, same with the Chicago Sting lads and the New England T-Men. All those places, as you say, those pockets, they had that sort of cachet in the community because it was such a, you know, it was such a revelation back then. It was, I mean, the Cosmos were growing all of their sports teams. Ourselves down here in our neck of the woods, well, we were the only game in town next to the Dolphins. There wasn't any Miami Heat. There wasn't even a Miami Hurricanes football team. And I think around the country, when you looked at the gates that the likes of Chicago were getting and New England, the way they were drawing in, Seattle, Portland, these places, wherever you went, I mean, you would always, after the game, you would always have that sort of, you'd go out with the guys and instantly have that, you know, recognition of getting into nightclubs and stuff like that. But really, I think the other side of it was more intriguing for these players, likes of Pelé and Beckenbauer, that they could stroll down Fifth Avenue and really wouldn't exactly you know, be set upon as they were in Brazil and in Germany. But, you know, that the movie showed that when they were put in an environment where they were given that acknowledgement of who they were and what they were, like when Pelé went to that baseball game and the adulation he received, that would have been typical as well. But I just, as I say, I thought the other side of the coin was wonderful. I remember talking to Gerd Müller and saying he couldn't get out of his house. He couldn't leave his house to go and get a loaf of bread or whatever.
Thank you, Ray. Melissa, do you have a question?
Yes, thanks. I actually, it's sort of a two-part question, and what you were just talking about was making me think about this. And thank you so much, Ray, for your commentary. I absolutely love it on Gold TV. I was wondering what you think about these summer tours that big clubs from Europe and, you know, like Brazil and Argentina is going to play here. What you think about these tours, these kind of revenue tours, what impact they may actually have here in the U.S., because they're very glamorous, but I wonder if it actually helps the sport or it gives off the impression that we have to wait for these really quality sides to come. I mean, I know they fill stadiums. And that sort of relates to me wanting to ask you how you've seen the place of the sport change in U.S. society during your whole tenure here. So thank you.
We've lost Ray. Hang on. Let me get him. I'm calling him right back.
While Alex calls back, just to follow up on Melissa's point and keep the flow going, Bogicevic style. The tours that Cosmos were doing abroad, has anybody written about this? Does anybody know?
I don't think there is any scholarship about that. This is Stephen, by the way.
Hello?
Hi, Ray. Sorry we lost you. Let me just restate.
All right, Alex.
Let me restate Melissa's question for you here real quick. She was asking about both the European club tours and some national side tours here in the United States and what your assessment of their impact is, and she wanted to lead that into a second question, which was, how have you seen, during your tenure in this country as a whole, the sport evolve in that sense of these marquee tour events?
Are you talking about the types of tours from the likes of Real Madrid?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's an absolutely wonderful thing, and it shows you again how far the game has come in this country. I remember that first season in 1977 with the Fort Lauderdale Strikers here, and we played Lazio. We played the fabulous Lazio right here in Lockhart Stadium, and there was probably about 4,000 or 5,000 people there. I'll never forget it for another reason. I had having a very good season that year, in my first year, and Ron Newman, my coach, asked me, because I'd been scoring goals from midfield and being a lot more creative than what he had expected, he says, I'm going to try to push you up tonight and play up front, play as the forward, the centre forward. I says, Ron, I'm not too sure about that. And he says, well, just give it a try. Well, I'll never forget my first experience against playing against Italian defenders. And this was back in the 70s, because what the marks that I had on my body after that game, and I'm just talking about the lower part of my body, I'm talking about my rib cage, my neck, everything. And I came in at half time and I said, Ron, I'm moving back to midfield. You can do what you damn well like, but that was it. But getting back to the original question, there was a multitude of Italians that night. It was a big, strong Italian flavor, and it was a great atmosphere because, you know, the Italian fans were coming out. Even the opposing fans, like of Milan and Inter Milan, I'll never forget, they were all congregated in a massive area behind the goal, and they were going absolutely bananas. And it was fabulous, but it wasn't a big event. It was a very much, you know, I think the next week we played, against somebody like Toronto or St. Louis, and we got three times as many people. Well, that would never happen today. And I think when these wonderful teams, the likes of Barcelona and Real Madrid, Manchester United, Chelsea, these phenomenal things, Boca Juniors, of course. When they come to these clubs now, it's a massive occasion, and it's one of the highlights of the season. I think it's great for the fans to see these wonderful institutions. And there'll always be, you know, the argument that, well, these teams come just for the money or just for, you know, they're on holiday. So the games really don't mean that much. And that may be the case, you know, in a lot of ways. There is some substance behind that. And yet, I think the game is so set and established in this country now that when these teams do come, they don't want to be embarrassed by the American sides. They want to put on a display for the American following, for the market, if you like. I hate that word, but they want to do that for their own benefit, to show that they have, you know, full respect for who they're playing against and where they're playing. So that whole snowball's just got bigger and bigger, and you see how these teams love coming back. I was reading a wonderful interview from Sir Alex Ferguson, seeing how he loves coming to the United States with Manchester United, and Jose Mourinho said exactly the same thing. You know, there's nowhere that the players enjoy coming more than the USA. So, you know, just like us when we were 22-year-old kids, some things never change, and the wonderful country attracts them. But the game now has reached a level where it's even more enticing for these clubs now.
Excellent. Stephen, you have a follow-up?
Yes, please. Ray, Again, I'm coming back to this. We got this conversation in Fort Lauderdale. If you compare MLS to NASL, when we watch the movie, we can see that actually there were quite a few successful teams in the NASL. And Clive Toy said that there were maybe like five or six teams that were very successful. MLS never really managed to get that many teams. Do you think that if NASL had the single entity way of functioning, they would have survived?
You know, it's an intriguing question, Stephen. But you know, I'm not so sure that it probably would have. But I'm not so sure that the Cosmos probably would have wanted that to be the working formula. They certainly wanted to be, you know, the Rolling Stones of the game. They didn't want to be with, you know, Barry Manilow's like we were down here and that type of thing. It would have probably been a lot more prudent financially because a lot of people lost a lot of money. And again, the pride that I have with my team, when we moved from Fort Lauderdale to Minnesota, I believe there was only Minnesota Strikers and the Toronto team, Toronto Blizzard, that were the only two teams, the two franchises that wanted to continue. It was the rest of them that jumped ship into the Major Indoor Soccer League. So I think that was obviously the Robbie family was a huge part of that, and they firmly believed, as much as Mr. Phil Anschutz does now, that the future is so great for the game in this country. Joe Robbie certainly had that dream and stuck with it till its dying throes. That was a shame, obviously, beyond a shame. It was a tragic development when they moved into indoor soccer. But it just moved along, and Stephen, and who knows? It might have worked. You know, we'll never know. But it's certainly the way to go for the game in this country at this point. These very engineered steps, that's very carefully considered now by the brain trust in New York at MLS, and you know, I think they're doing a fantastic job.
Great. Well, we asked
just to follow up quickly. In the NASL, there were quite a few teams that were keeping the league afloat for almost 16 years. And in MLS, we only have the Galaxy. Well, we have obviously Toronto, that was a successful franchise, and Seattle. And that's not enough. I mean, my point is, you mentioned the New York Red Bulls. In New York, there are sometimes close to 100,000 people watching Manchester United, Manchester City, or Chelsea and Tottenham, etc. But there are 5,000 or 6,000 people watching the MLS game, and this is not enough. So, how do you think that MLS can benefit really from the past mistakes and benefits in order to improve and especially? They're opening a new team in Montreal. Where do you think it will be the best place to open a 20 team for MLS in order for it to be successful?
Yeah, I'm sure those are massive questions that the MLS brain trust and their ownership groups are all very aware of. And, you know, that there are too few teams being able to generate the type of figures it's going to be able to turn a profit. But it seems that these owners and the people running the ship, Stephen, are extremely aware of that and have got very, very deep pockets and are going to maintain this and try to keep the structure going towards being, you know, very, very viable financially. And they're very, very close now, from what I understand. It's obviously because of these phenomenal stadiums that they've been built in terms of the, you know, the revenue streams and language like that I have no understanding of, but it's simple that they've got their own homes now and they're going to be able to do well in the decades to come, but it's going to take time. And again, they're being so very, very careful on where they expand to. It would seem like when watching that movie, you know, again, going back to the movie, it was a situation where basically the door was open for expansion teams, no matter where it was. That's not the case anymore with MLS, and that's a great thing. And I think they've learned those lessons so, you know, very carefully. Whereas in the older days, that expansion of NESL, it came way too suddenly, way too quick, and the game couldn't keep pace with it. This gradual stepping up by MLS on a number of different various aspects of the game and the marketings and all the paraphernalia around it has been pretty much spot on. This is coming from somebody that we fell on our swords here, or were forced onto them in Miami. But was it the proper thing to do for the welfare of the league? It probably was. And those things you just have to accept as part of the growing process of the game in this country.
Great. I think we have some questions here in East Lansing. And I just wanted to note for the audio record some of the chat that's going on. Stephen was talking about the TV ratings when he was mentioning those figures. Both David and Melissa noted that the actual attendance figures for the Red Bulls and Dynamo have been fairly good, but he was specifying the money that's generated from television. But Peter, we can lead off with a question from you.
I'm not sure it's a question, more I guess a set of thoughts or comments, but I want to shift the discussion a little bit away from MLS and contemporary things and try to look at this film as a historical document as well as a historical interpretation. I like the way this film really did bring the past to life, and it has a personal resonance because I was born and grew up in Rome, Italy, dodging those Italian defenders gnawing at my ankles. and it's in a sense, this film brought me back to a year when my father had gotten a lectureship for several months here in the States. I think it was late 1980, early 1981. And the thing that worried me the most was I'm going to a country with no football. Yeah. And I was really, really concerned because at the time I had dreams of becoming some kind of a top-notch footballer. Such are the dreams of childhood. But then when I arrived, I was stunned. The NASL season was on. There was no American football season yet when we arrived. I think they were about to start. And, you know, there were places I could see on TV where there were 20, 30, 40,000 people in the stands on occasion. And I think it was ABC who was showing the games. And, yes. Okay, I thought it was weird that they had the clock winding down and they had the 35-yard line and some other odd things. They played on plastic and et cetera. But, you know, Giorgio Ghinaglia, who won the title with Lazio in my home city in 1974 and got thrown off the national team for telling the coach to buzz off in the 1974 World Cup, was there and he was scoring goals. And I signed up for a youth team. And the first game we played was against a nice group of kids from I don't remember where, who were wearing Strikers kits, Ray, by the way.
Well,
and I thought, how cool was that? And then people, some of the parents started calling me Ghinaglia because I had big hair and scored a few goals. And I thought, man, this country's going places. And a few years later, I ended up staying here. And here I am many, many years later, still playing football and having the pleasure of having these conversations with you. But what I want to just point out is that the film is a documentary, and we tend to think of documentaries as more or less accurate interpretations of the past. But I think it's useful to also listen to what Robert Rosenstone, who wrote a book called Visions of the Past a few years ago, says about documentary films. And then maybe we can get some responses about this from the rest of the group. Quote, "The apparent glory of the documentary is that it can open a direct window onto the past. In this case, it's cities, stadiums, games, goals. As the DVD case says,
greed, girls, and that's just the first half, right? But this ability, Rosenstone says, also constitutes its chief danger. However much film uses footage from a particular time and place to create a realistic sense of the historical moment, we must remember that on the screen, we see not just the events themselves and not the events as experienced or even witnessed by the participants, but selected images of those events carefully arranged into sequences to tell a particular story or to make a particular argument. So, any thoughts, responses to that? The film as history, in a way, and the film as not a book, which is how most of us jock nerds tend to work.
Well, let me just say that right at the start of this conversation, I came out and said that I thought it was a really nicely balanced type of entertainment, of a movie that was wonderfully constructed, had all sorts of different aspects. And yes, that quote from that gentleman is right. It is extremely selective when you're making that sort of documentary. It has to be. But I don't think there was any real bias one way. It wasn't a promotional. It was sad in a lot of ways, and very melancholy feelings that I got washing over me watching the game, thinking, those were the days. But it also encapsulated various feelings for me when I was watching the movie. And I go back to the use of the tremendous soundtrack, as corny as that sounds. But, the selection of the people they interviewed and their forthrightedness as well, the likes of Clive Toy, Rodney Marsh, they were coming out and saying things that weren't particularly flattering towards either different people at different times. And yet, it needed to be said, and it needed to I thought it did a very good job throwing a lasso around a very special time, and did the titles, the words of the title, proud, because there was never anything before the NESL, there was never anything like it afterwards. It was truly once in a lifetime, and I thought that movie captured it as well as could possibly be imagined, perhaps.
And I think you're right. I mean, the emotions that this film gets out of us are wonderful, and that's something a book can rarely do.
Let me tell you this, guys. For everybody that's listening, I'm sure that there'll be several of you that are aware of another wonderful documentary. It's called Pelada, spelled P-E-L-A-D-A, Pelada. And I think it means naked, as much as I can understand from the guys at GoTV. But you need to get this. Go online and look into it. And this is a documentary made by two college kids at the time, a girl and a boyfriend, Gwendolyn, I think. And it was Gwendolyn, and I kind of think of the other guy that's in it. But they go around the world, and they're looking for the game. They're not going to the Bernabeu. They're not going to the Bombonera. They're not going to St. James's Park. They go to play these pickup games. And it's a documentary, and it's not about the game. It's about the ball, if you understand what I mean. When you see this great little documentary, for me, it's another wonderful telling of a story of about the game. And Pelada, for me, reached beyond. It's nothing as glamorously produced as Once in a Lifetime, far from it. But for me, that was the whole appeal. So please look and see if you can get a copy of Pelada, because I think you'll all love it.
Well, we can maybe do one better, and I know many of us have seen that documentary, but if you would like, you can actually participate in a discussion of that. We'll try and get a hold of the producers of that and maybe do that for our next film session, because we have a running plan to incorporate more films into these discussions, and I agree, it's a fantastic film. We can move on in the room here in East Lansing, and Ben can perhaps ask a question.
Yeah, this is really interesting. I'm glad we're doing U.S. soccer at last in here. I think it often gets overlooked, so I'm really happy about that. And I'm a big MLS fan. I'm a season ticket holder at the Columbus Crew. I go down there a good few times a season to see games and stuff, and I really like the MLS. I really like the product. But to take it back to the movie, to the documentary, if we believe the end of the documentary, it would seem like the MLS is it's almost like the NASL takes praise for the MLS. You know, it's evolved from this. But the way I see it and the history that I've read of it is that the MLS is surviving and doing well despite the NASL rather than because of it as such. And going back to what Peter's saying about maybe romanticizing just how great the NASL was. But I mean, so I guess what is the legacy of the NASL is what I'm asking. I mean, is it the fact that it basically stopped and there was no soccer in the US for 10, 15 years until the World Cup and the MLS, there was no professional soccer. No US national team made the World Cup during this time. There was no infrastructure below the NASL. Yeah. So should we take this documentary as right that, you know, the New York Cosmos and these teams really evolved into the MLS and that it's a real success of it, or is it happening despite the frailties of the NASL?
Yeah, I really think they're pretty two separate entities entirely. I think a lot of credit is given to NASL for creating this wonderful awareness of the game on the level that it succeeded, bringing these incredible gods of the game, I keep calling them, but that's what they were. And every team around this country had two or three or four World Cup stars. I remember playing in this one game here at Lockhart Stadium against the Cosmos, and there was eight World Cup winning captains on the team, on the field at the same time. So, you know, but we've already heard from people that witnessed the days of the NASL and had a profound effect on them. Most of the players that have passed through the national team recently over the last decade or couple of decades, time goes so quickly, were hugely influenced by the NASL experience. But that's not to say that it was like a passing of the baton from NASL to MLS. It wasn't. I mean, it dissolved horribly, and it was the shooting star that was phenomenal, as the movie captured. But to say that, you know, the NASL was had this wonderful halo around it and just was the, you know, the last step before MLS took over, I think that's pushing it a little bit. But I think there's an indebtedness that the sport has to what NASL did achieve, and now it's moved up several gears, you know. It was, as I said earlier, truly was a badly constructed league in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
At the time. And MLS is quite the opposite. So I think they've learned hugely from the mistakes. And that's part of the irony, that they learned more from the mistakes of the NASL, perhaps, than they did from its success.
Yeah, and just to follow up, I mean, there's that scene where you see Franz Beckenbauer at the airport and a player from the 90 World Cup team in the US is there, Mike Windisham, I think his name is, something like that. You know, and they're trying to draw a correlation between the two, and I felt that was kind of stretching a bit in the documentary. We talked about the World Cup, and Steve Ross in the documentary talks about, you know, he basically gives up when the World Cup doesn't come to the US in 86 as being a big reason as well for the failure of the NASL. But surely the bigger thing is kind of going back to what Stephen was saying earlier on, and it's TV figures. I mean, ABC comes in for this 1 year and then basically gives up. And the documentary doesn't really touch upon that. There's somebody from ABC says, yeah, we tried for a year. We couldn't get the figures. So, you know, soccer's not good on the TV in the USA. But, I mean, they tried for 1 year. And they didn't get the figures. MLS struggled for years to – it was losing money showing soccer. It's only just recently started to make money showing soccer on American TV. So, I mean, for me anyway, I think ABC is a you know, big part of the reason why the NASL failed, because they gave up after a year of trying to show it.
I remember those afternoons as a player when we tune in to watch the games. And you know, they did so many things wrong. I mean, we would play games. I remember this one game we played, a wonderful game, as it turned out, against the Detroit Express here at Lockhart Stadium that was on ABC. Trevor Francis, tremendous ex-England international, played for Sampdoria, I believe, in Italy. But he was just one of the stars on it, but it was played in mid-June or July in Florida under, it must have been 102, 103 that afternoon. And now we can just imagine the process of the bad ideas that they were coming up with. How more can we, you know, screw things up? The commentaries of the game, the selling of the game, you know, taking on people that had really, Jim McKay, you know, one of the most lauded, wonderful, venerable announcers. I remember him coming into our locker room and sitting down with us and trying to figure out the game. So there was a multitude of hurdles that they had to try to overcome. And you know, they really didn't. And I agree that the failure of the TV package was as big of a mortal blow to that league as anything. And it comes back, isn't it? It's amazing. Again, it's another part of this astonishing mystery of a riddle in this country as we're examining the game. Now we live in this country with 24-hour-a-day soccer channels. Nowhere else in the world has that, where they're specifically for the game. We've got GoTV and Fox Soccer Channel, and all of the others, you know, the wonderful Spanish channels and ESPN, of course, are in now. And part of the problem now that's facing this league and the development of the game in this country is that you can turn your television on and watch Lionel Messi in Barcelona, or you can go and watch the Columbus Crew, and you can do both. And that's what we hope is happening. The game day experience is so wonderful, you enjoy it, and MLS is totally aware of that, I'm sure. I know they are. But still, it's a part of the problem that nowadays we're so spoilt. I can watch the Argentinian League, the Colombian League, the Brazilian League, the Italian League. It's a flick of a switch now. Now, when that movie was made, we had one, when Once in a Lifetime was made, we had one TV show. I think it was called Soccer Made in Germany. And it was one game once a week on terrible reception, but with a wonderful commentator as well. And it was part of that wonderful commentary that was delivered during the game that was as appealing as the actual footage of the football. And therein lies a key, I believe, to the selling of the game in this country.
Thanks. I think I got some quotes for an article I want to write from you there, Ray. So thanks a lot. I appreciate it. I won't ask a question, but I just want to say thanks as well for your commentary. I enjoy listening to you as well. And I'm from the north of England as well. I'm from down near Hull. And I grew up playing a lot in Bridlington and Scarborough and places like that, which aren't far from Gateshead. And I got kicked a lot playing in those areas. So I can't believe that the first time you ever got kicked was by Italian defenders, because people in Newcastle, Gateshead, Sunderland, we you know, the north of England, we play quite rough too, I think. So I just want to
see.
I wanted to ask you a question, Ray, about the film again, and maybe your personal experience both as a player and a coach. The film draws a clear contrast when Pelé arrives between teacher and students. Pelé comes and he is there to not only through his play improve the cosmos, but also through showing to show his American teammates how to play the game. And there's this wonderful scene where he is pointing towards his back as the throw-in is being taken, and his teammate doesn't know what he's trying to do.
Yeah.
So it captures that brilliantly, the film. But I wanted to ask, you know, watching some of the footage before Pelé arrives, I mean, there was some fairly impressive talent on display, certainly not up to the levels of the world's best. But how much did you experience both on the Strikers and then with your time in as a coach as well, that sort of clear divide between Americans as students of the game and the foreigners coming in and teaching them how to play soccer? Because I think the film, sort of as an editorial note, obscures maybe a bit of the talent and history of the players here in this country to kind of make a flourish about Pelé coming to the country, which taking nothing away was, you know, certainly a teacher-student relationship in terms of level of talent.
Certainly. You know, I think everybody that was playing with these wonderful players, I know my game, as an example, improved infinitely after the first game in 77, which in that Strikers team were basically a bunch of ragtag and bobtails, even though we finished with that incredible record above the Cosmos. So we were doing it off our own bat. Our superstar was a one-eyed goalkeeper, Gordon Banks, who was well past his prime, but was still the most inspirational personality and wonderful experience. But then after that year, I saw myself becoming such a more complete footballer because I played with George Best, Gordon, Nene Kubias, Francisco Mourinho, Gerd Müller, and on and on and on. And the same thing with the young rookies that were coming out of the college system as well. And those sorts of players always have that effect on you. And it's not just in those days that that was occurring. I remember when I took over the Miami Fusion, and we had a wonderful, influential midfield player from England called Ian Bishop, who's a lovely footballer, played for Manchester City and West Ham, and should have played for England. He was that good, Ian. And he would have the same effect, and I saw it, and that took me back so many years to see these players. Like the Jay Heaps, I remember, who was a player from, I think he was from Duke University and was played a lot for the New England team under Stevie Nicol. And Jay being basically taught ABCs by Bishop in the early days and having that wonderful effect. But it certainly, you know, that's part of any club, any league, any way. But I think the learning curve for the young American lads was much more steep than what it is in the regular domestic leagues where you're growing up with your own sorts of people, your own players. When these people landed here, you had to really adapt quickly. And for a lot of those young American lads, the learning curve was just too steep, and the demands on them were too much. I think that was another. You saw Bobby Smith in the movie, which was fabulous to see Bobby again. And he is a real American lad who wasn't as talented as the likes of Werner Roth or Shep Messing. Bobby was a good, solid footballer. But I remember this one afternoon at Tampa Stadium, when I had the press pass and I was watching as a spectator, and I saw Carlos Alberto receive the ball. This was in Tampa Stadium against the Rowdies, virtually a sellout, fabulous afternoon. And Bobby dropped back to receive the ball from Carlos. And Alberto looked at naturally to try to knock the ball, which he just, you know, advanced the possession. And he saw it was Bobby. And in an instant, he turned the other way. And I'll never forget that. I thought, wow, look at that. He doesn't trust them enough to give him a ball in a tight situation. That was another one of those Kodak moments that I'll never forget and was evidence of what you were talking about earlier on.
I know Stephen had a follow-up that he was wanting to ask a few minutes ago. Stephen, are you there?
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, it is again to just come back. I think that it was not done enough in the. It's a great movie, Once in a Lifetime. Unfortunately, they couldn't get Pelé. They couldn't get another important participants. So, what do you think is the role? Let me put it that way. There are a lot of sports movies in the United States, like Hoosiers, Rudy, etc. And I've never seen. And let's also talk about documentaries. I saw a documentary about Joe Namath. Great documentaries about American sports athletes, but nothing on soccer. And there were a few movies actually. We all like them. We can probably do another section on soccer in the movies. What would be the impact of a really great documentary? Let's say just you put everybody together, Pelé accepts to talk. They managed to get Ray, you know, to participate in this movie. Do you think that it could help American soccer? And on the other hand, this is a documentary. How about the just great Hollywood movie? Because, you know, they tried to do a couple of movies, but they were nice. I mean, soccer was nice in Victory, but it really sucked in pardon my French, in Goal, but it was a great plot. It's something it always misses, you know. It's a great documentary or a Hollywood movie can help the game. Just I would just ask Ray to comment after that, and we can go around the table after that.
Yeah, I think it's a very difficult, you know, sports movies are always extremely difficult, it seems, to absolutely nail, you know, bullseye. And I thought this picture, the documentary format, worked extremely well, because it seems that soccer, when it's taken to a level of Hollywood standards, doesn't seem quite the real game. I mean, the bend it like Beckham type of experience, which is a nice, fuzzy, feel-good movie in a lot of ways, with a good message, for sure, but not in terms of portraying the real game. And I think you could say that for a lot of the sports, horse racing, even boxing, there's so many of them. So I don't think it's just our game. And when you see a movie that's done well, like The Damned United, it could never hold a candle to that wonderful book. It was good, but for me, the actual footage of the game that was displayed in that movie was, you know, it was very, it just seemed completely staged. And that's the way it is. I think it's impossible to get, we saw it in Victory, you know, and as you said, in Goal, which I thought was a half-decent attempt at capturing it. But, you know, it seems that if we're going to get something that actually works, it probably has to be something in between the two, perhaps, where it's actually a structured movie with highlight footage or documentary footage type of you know, interlaced in the movie. I think it's been done with some success. I watched a wonderful picture there the other week called 66, which is a pretty hilarious movie in itself, about this poor Jewish lad whose bar mitzvah falls on the day that England play the World Cup final, and the whole event leading up to it, and everybody's telling them that England have got no chance, don't worry about it, they'll never get to the final. And the process of the tournament is captured through snippets that's laced into the picture, and I thought that worked very well.
I know Peter wanted to follow up, and Stephen wanted to follow up on the question as well, and then I think David wants to ask a new question.
I'm glad we're moving back to the sports film discussion, because the academic that I mentioned before, Rosenstone, argues strongly in favor of what Ray was just saying, that if a new football film, such as the one that's been discussed now, were to be made, it would have to combine to be really good, the documentary approach and the Hollywood feature approach. So you're in sync with Rosenstone, Ray. I also looked up before coming the ESPN's top sports documentaries. This is something they did a while back. They had five Americans, as far as I know, doing their top 10 lists. And these included the two journalists from ESPN, the filmmaker Morgan Spurlock, and a couple of other people. And guess what? The only soccer movie that made it into anyone's top 10 was Once in a Lifetime. The two ESPN guys, in fact, Bill Simmons ranked at number 10, and Gary Belsky, at the time he was the editor-in-chief of ESPN, the magazine, ranked at number 8. So it's interesting to see that finally there's a soccer movie that can break into the top 10 for all sports documentaries, according to these guys. If you're interested in looking at the rankings, you can just search ESPN top sports documentaries. They also have one for top 10 sports films, you know, the Hoosiers and the Rocky and the Raging Bull and so on and so forth. My question here was about the role of Pelé. It's too bad that Clive Torrey couldn't join us because in the book by the same title by Gavin Newsham, Clive is quoted, you know, as having pursued Pelé for many, many years, seemingly flying all over the world and trying to get these 5-minute audiences with him and finally sealing the deal somewhere, I think, actually about 2 miles from my house in Rome. Pelé is also the pivot of the narrative of this film, right? I mean, once he signed and all the glamour and the glitz and the media attention happened, you know, soccer is on the map. And then when Pelé retires after that famous game where he plays one half with Cosmos and one half with Santos, the arc starts to go down, right? But the NASL actually went on for 7 years after Pelé, and the movie gives relatively short thrift to those 7 years. And also, Pelé is not interviewed in the film. All of the footage with Pelé is archival footage. There's at least one allegation that he wanted to be paid something along the lines of $100,000 US to be interviewed. And in the book, I was just rereading it last night, apparently one of the reasons Pelé was so interested in coming to the Cosmos is that he was heavily indebted. Not unlike Johan Cruyff, who was deep, deep in the hole when he came to the U.S. But yet none of that is really discussed in the movie. The kind of dark side of football, if you will, is not mentioned very much, even though you are left with a history of failure, which you don't see much in U.S. sports films either. And I think that's interesting. So just some thoughts maybe on this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the old wonderful points and very very good points that you make. Again, it comes back to that that question of how much time and the structuring of a movie like this. I'll use the expression putting a lasso around it. Well, you know, how big can you make it? Perhaps there were. I think that's always the sign of a great documentary, where they look at, you know, the underlying parts that, you know, that aren't too appealing. One of the other aspects of the movie that I thought was a big exclusion was the strike that took place in 1978, which was a big problem for the league and for us players, that we didn't have a collective bargaining agreement. And that was a big thing, and it's not alluded to whatsoever. And that was a big moment in this sport, because a lot of it came to an edge where it could have went the other way. These owners were saying, if there's no agreement, we're pulling out. And we as players, a lot of us, felt that it was, you know, just patently unfair with this working bargaining agreement that we didn't have. And we were willing to stand up for our rights. And a lot of us did, but those superstars, the likes of virtually all of the superstars that came to this country, they all played. And that wasn't alluded to at all. That was a fact that was, you know, quietly dismissed.
Yeah, no, it seems interesting. Now in the chat, people are mentioning surprised that the two Escobars, the ESPN 30 for 30 film, isn't mentioned in that list. And it just strikes me, this observation, that the two Escobars is really a film about Colombian society that features on one half the life of a soccer player and on the other the life of a drug lord. And it strikes me that there's glimpses in Once in a Lifetime that we could say the film gives us a perspective on, perhaps not something as large as American society, but certainly the American sportscape. But even then, it's only in bits. And I wonder, maybe partially to Ray, but also to Ben, who's studying U.S. soccer more explicitly, you know, what the NASL experience tells us about American society, not in sort of a long-form argument, but what bits about the late 70s and early 80s can we appreciate in a different light, you know, with the history of the NASL? Because I think the film Two Escobars really gives us a picture of Colombia that we don't get elsewhere, and is really singular in that.
Right. I really, you know, I'm not sure that either the movie or that league in itself was looking to make any, you know, great cultural statement in and of itself. I think they just want these people, these wonderful dreamers, if you like, that were at the top, the likes of Clive Toy and Phil Woosnam and Steve Ross, these fabulous people, Joe Robbie, just wanted to bring a sport that they knew, you know, in the bottom of their hearts, that was going to be a great thing for this country and for the youth of the country, for the sports landscape, and you know, and inevitably their bottom line. But you know, these other wonderful pictures that are brought from these different countries with a far greater soccer culture. That's a whole different spectrum, I think, and not one that, you know, I don't think we should even be concerned about right now. I don't think we have, you know, the need for anything that way as of yet. Perhaps the next big one will be if it's a situation involving MLS, because that's obviously going to be the next shoe to fall, and I don't mean fail. But, you know, this success story that is developing in front of our eyes now, for whatever you want to call it, for all its shortcomings and all of its challenges, it seems impervious to anything. Every season that comes along, it seems to make another positive step. But there's going to be a crunch time whereby if these TV ratings and the rest of it don't start catching, there'll be a lot more serious questions to be asked.
Does anyone online have there's some activity going on in the chat that I'm not sure if Melissa wants to follow up on, or I see David typing, but anyone that wants to, yeah, go ahead, David.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, Ray, you already mentioned the great soundtrack in this documentary and how it kind of brings you back to that era really well. I wonder if you could speak to the close relationship between British rock stars at the time and the NASL players. It seems to me it was a really special time in terms of the role that rock and roll was playing in pop culture, especially in America at the time. And you had people like Rick Wakeman of Yes and Elton John, who were actually involved as owners of NASL franchises, and the, you know, the whole party lifestyle of both rock and rollers and soccer players at the time, and how very different that scene must have been then from now. You know, in the you know, since Wenger took over at Arsenal, everything has changed, and the idea of players going out and getting drunk and snorting cocaine and whatnot with Mick Jagger and the likes, just inconceivable.
You're absolutely right. The real fact of the matter is that we had it all. We had it all, man. We, you know, this was before the AIDS epidemic. The wonderful time of sexual liberation of women, right around, you know, the mid 70s. The flower power was still lingering around. Spring break here in Fort Lauderdale was a scene that you cannot begin to put into a movie. And it was going on everywhere. We could party. We could party very hard after a game. My Lord, we had Gerd Müller and Gordon and George Best in the same team. And God rest in peace, George, who's a wonderful friend of mine. And Gerd, of course, was a fabulous player for us for 3 years. But you didn't want to get behind those two players on the warm-up the next morning as you were jogging around the field, because the smell of the beer of whiskey was just off the chart. And that's the way it was. Nowadays, that's inconceivable, you know. It's a different time altogether. But again, that lovely little picture seemed to capture that. You know, the showed you the scenes at Studio 54, and again encapsulated that time and that lovely moment where, you know, disco was at its height. John Travolta was kicking ass everywhere. Mick Jagger, and you know, he, remember when he was at the Cosmos. But it was, I remember Tom Jones coming and working out with us, you know? Tom Jones, I mean, of course, that was just because Ron Newman, our coach, was a big fan of his. But it was amazing. And like I said, I thought that movie really did, they didn't get, they got the right, they got. I thought that was a big aspect of that movie. I'll tell you guys, I want to just mention one more movie that I'm not sure if you are all aware of either. And this is a documentary about the Spanish Clásico game between Barcelona and Real Madrid. And it's the history of that incredible rivalry and the games. And it's fabulously captured as well. It's called El Clásico, More Than a Game. And I think they have their own webpage and stuff called elclásico.org. If you want to look into it, you'll really enjoy that one as well. A very good documentary. But again, not quite as glitzy or as laden with the sequence is what Once in a Lifetime had, and I think that was a really good picture.
Ray, how about you told me something that almost players back then were associated like British rock stars, and they created these great shows, and you guys would arrive on a double decker painted in the Union Jack colors, and the other game would be on Harley Davidson's gotten from the local dealership, or on ponies gotten from the local Seminole Native Americans. This was almost like it was better than like the leading rock band at the time. I mean, I'm trying to get the name, probably the Beatles. Can you comment on this? Like the parallel between, the Britishness?
Yeah, you know, that was always, and again, you look at that movie there last night. See, I don't know if this is what you're alluding to here, but this, you could, I thought, not one of the failings of the movie, but one of the things that when I was watching it, looking in and not being a Cosmos player, but you see, this was what it was. It was the Cosmos movie, basically. It wasn't about NESL. It was about the Cosmos towing the NESL behind it. But if you had have seen some of the build-ups to the games, like say Tampa Bay and in our own town in Fort Lauderdale, I'm sure it was the same in the likes of Vancouver and Seattle and New England, where the build-up to the game and everything surrounding the game was so incredible that, I mean, the cosmos really didn't need to do that because it had its own, you know, fabulous brand and the wonderful stars to sell it behind. But, you know, that part of it could have been fed into the movie. It would have been amazing. You know, our pre-game festivities were what as big a part of the pull to the game itself and to that wonderful occasion as the actual 90 minutes of football. It just was. And it showed, I think Stevie Hunt brought it out in one of the interviews that Stevie did, who was, by the way, the most underrated Cosmos player, in my opinion. But Stevie had said how, you know, the tailgating ahead of the game was as big a part of the experience as anything. And that was indeed the case.
Yeah. Well, we're closing in on 90 minutes here, and that's how we generally structure our time limits. But Melissa does have a question, and she hasn't gotten to talk much. So why don't we toss it out to Melissa's added time question, and then we can thank everybody and wrap things up.
Okay, I'll try to be really brief. My question is, and going back to this idea of documentary, really so much being about how we interpret history, and so those people who remember NASL might have a particular interpretation, and I'm wondering how, if any of you have seen it with youth or gotten reaction from younger people watching it, what kinds of reactions that generates?
I guess it depends on what you define by younger. I watched it with Alex and his girlfriend, who, you know, I could be their father.
But I'm thinking...
And you have nine.
And I got this image. I was born in Bulgaria, and for me, the NASL and Cosmos was just the gritty capitalists. They were professionals, and we were amateurs. And, you know, my father would tell me the best players played in the United States, and I always wanted to see him, but we didn't have any footage. And I was fortunate to acquire actually quite a few DVDs. And I don't know, it was always something that I couldn't see, but I was fortunate to get, you know, a couple of decades later on.
So, Melissa, what do you think about youth? I mean, what's your definition of youth, I guess?
Well, I'm thinking of definitely student age. So people in the U.S. who have grown up with soccer, you know, post-94, soccer's a thing that they know. It's a sport that's actually out there. They play it. They see it. How they might interpret that history when they see the film?
I mean, anecdotally, I'm right at that age group. I'm 25, but my formative experience, I was 7 years old when the 94 World Cup was here, and I remember going to the Silver Dome to watch three games. And when I have been exposed to the history of the NASL, it's kind of a strange feeling. I almost feel like I own part of it because I grew up at a time, at least in Michigan where I grew up, where my father being from Ecuador and my mother being from Spain, you know, soccer was a part of life in a way that it wasn't for other children. So when even though I didn't live this era, I know all those names because I grew up hearing them. And even though I never got to see any of the NASL, I almost feel like I own part of that history as it pertains to being a pre-1994 World Cup history. And I almost feel like, you know, I was there before the rest of my generation was, and especially people my age, maybe people a little bit younger who are still in their undergraduate years. I mean, wearing soccer jerseys now is so acceptable that it's almost mainstream, whereas wearing soccer jerseys around when I was in high school or even early in my undergraduate years was very, very rare. But I'm almost more interested in knowing what, for example, Peter's daughters think of watching such a game, because they're 10 years old now. And they have known a very different soccer landscape than I have, and we're not very far removed in age.
Yeah, well, I've been thinking about showing my daughters, who are both keen soccer girls, the film. I'm a little concerned about certain aspects of the film. but I know they get bored by Talking Heads. So there are maybe a few too many interviews for them to keep their interest levels up, but I know they would enjoy the match footage, and I know they would love to see the fan crowd scenes because they were in South Africa with me for the World Cup, and we saw many American fans outside the games tailgating, something that incidentally South Africans love to do with Americans. There's nothing more national in South Africa, black, white, and everything in between, than putting some meat on the grill and having some nice beers to go with it. So, I'm still thinking about whether I'm going to show them the movie in its entirety, but maybe they're a little bit too young. If they were 13 or 14, maybe I'd be a little more comfortable with it.
David definitely wants to jump in here. Maybe David can jump in, and Ray, if you've seen it with anyone, any youths yourself, you can comment on it, and then maybe we can wrap things up with Melissa. So go ahead, David, and then Ray, and then Melissa.
Yeah, I've got a real complicated answer. I'll try to keep brief. My kids, I've got an 8-year-old daughter and an 11-year-old son, and they've watched this film several times. There's a few scenes, a few comments I hope they don't really understand, they've watched Once in a Lifetime a few times, and for them, you know, it's a matter of, you know, they know Shep Messing. They've seen him, they've spoken with him, they've had their, you know, they've met him on several occasions, but he's a commentator, so to know that he had a career as a player before is, I think, a little bit surprising. But I think it's a matter of kind of like a legacy lost. You know, they see my old Cosmos gears around, around the house, and the signed balls, jerseys, programs, what have you. But there's a big gap between the Cosmos and then the MetroStars Red Bulls. You know, they kind of grew up at Giant Stadium. But they never really saw the home team before a sellout crowd unless they were playing an exhibition against Barcelona. So I think it's a matter of, you know, why aren't we still the Cosmos, and why is there that gap? I've also screened the film for college students. You know, I've shown it in my classes. And for them, I think they're kind of shocked. You know, they see Real Madrid as the Galacticos, and to know that the Galacticos were actually here at one point, really, with the Cosmos, is a little shocking for 20-somethings, late teens, early 20-somethings in New York. To again, the idea that this thing happened and then poof, it disappeared. How did that happen? What went wrong?
Yeah. I think I think we can all agree in a lot of ways that it's probably as good of a time capsule for the league and for that time that was a very, very special time in the evolution of the game. It needed to have that sort of, we needed a Cosmos. The game did need that in order to get to where we are. It was invariably going to happen. And it was the only way that it could happen. And I think that was the genius of those men at the top that saw that, listen, we've tried everything. We're going nowhere. We need the best. We need, you know, this, you know, Lennon and McCartney and type of effect. The way the Beatles came and conquered the United States didn't quite happen along the same lines. But I thought that the movie in itself was a wonderful, you know, maybe nostalgia, but it was all based around facts. And again, I go back to how many of the other types of players were scattered over Canada and the United States of phenomenal world-class stars. And anybody that, you know, I think it's most of us here today that were privileged enough to watch that spectacle, however fleeting it was, can never be matched. It was just it was bloody marvelous, and I thought, you know, the picture did it justice and did a great job in so many ways, even despite, you know, stick it in the neck to Giorgio, which was hard to take a lot of times. But I do know that there's a lot of people thought that way, but it seemed to be pretty pointed for too long in the game. But, you know, there was evidently reason that they needed to maintain that. But
right. Stephen, go ahead real quick, and then I'll close it up for us.
Just real quick, Ray, thank you so much for taking the time to participate. You're one of my heroes. And hopefully next time when they do a continuation of this movie, they'll be able to get you to participate in the movie. Thank you, man. I really appreciate it.
Very well. Even my pleasure. Enjoyed it.
As for the group is concerned, I think we really enjoyed the film format, and we've done our last session was a pedagogy class on teaching soccer in the classroom. And I think both have demonstrated the fun we can have when we go outside of the book and the article for a little bit, but we will be back to those things. And I also wanted to mention for everybody that David Goldblatt is joining us here in East Lansing. He'll be our second in-person guest here, and we're going to wrap up the second half of his 900-page Bible on the history of soccer in a global sense right around St. Paddy's Day in March, so March 16th. So keep that on your radars. Very briefly, Ray, thank you so much for volunteering your time. I think we got a lot out of this, and we will treasure this recording as one of our more exciting ones. And if you ever feel the desire to come join us on another session about film, I'd like to get in touch with the people that made Pelada. As soon as I saw it, I really hope to bring them on board and see, really talk to them about the success of that film, because it's gotten close to getting the attention it deserves, but it's never quite broken out into a mainstream market. So I'd like to talk to them about that, and I think it's an important film as well. So thank you, everybody, for making the time to join us today. And again, thank you, Ray, for being our distinguished guest.
Okay, thanks, Alex, and thank you, everybody. I hope I brought a little bit of light to it. It's very difficult for all of us to try to throw our arms around the game and the whole development, not just this movie, but, you know, trying to focus in on certain parts. It's very challenging in itself. So, but I had a wonderful time answering all the questions, and good luck to everybody, and enjoy the journey.
Thank you, Ray. All right, everyone. Take care.
Thank you, Ray.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.